Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Werke, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Morning, everyone, and welcome to this February 16 Zoom panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's our second argument heard today in the case of State of Minnesota versus McClendon. I'll just advise the parties, even though we can see each other, and hear each other, and we can see each other's names. We're only making an audio recording of the proceeding, so please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. And if we have any technological glitches along the way, if you fail to see someone or anybody glitches and freezes, let us know and we'll try to pause the proceeding so we can let the technology catch up to us. We can sort things out. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Abigail Rankin and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Maurice Londell McClendon. I do intend to use the 5 minute rebuttal. I'd like to focus my argument today on two intertwined issues, the Spriegel evidence and the prosecutor's theme of predator-prey in closing argument. These issues are intertwined because without the Spriegel evidence, there would be no predator argument. And because of the Spriegel evidence, the predator argument became all the more problematic. As noted in
appellate- I need to ask you right away about your Spriegel evidence because I'm really confused. I look in your brief and you talk about how the district court failed to hold a hearing. Where do you get where do you come up with the notion that a hearing is required? I find that there's no merit to that argument.
Certainly. So the hearing is required here because the district court expressly stated that it would have such a hearing. In the district court's Spriegel order on page 4, as to the clear and convincing finding, the court wrote, quote, the finding was contingent upon JP appearing at trial and a hearing prior to the introduction of the evidence at trial, where the witness testifies that her recollection of the prior bad acts is consistent with the submitted police reports and counsel's argument to the court. The court continued, if the state
is able to- So if I understand then what you're saying is that perhaps you agree that a hearing is not required, but your argument is because the court said it would hold a hearing, that you're entitled to it?
Because the court indicated it would have that hearing in order to make the clear and convincing finding and finalize
it. Do you agree that as far as admission of Spriegel evidence that you don't need to have a hearing? I mean, do you agree with that premise?
Yes, I agree that a Spriegel hearing is not always required, but it is often advisable.
So your argument then is because the district court said something that's the basis for its failure to have clear and convincing evidence?
My argument is that the district court indicated it would have that hearing. That procedural error was a problem, that it did not have that hearing. The clear and convincing evidence piece kind of-
How were you prejudiced if the district court said it was going to have a hearing and in fact did not conduct such a hearing, whether it decided it was not necessary? How was your client prejudiced by that?
My client was prejudiced by that because the over 100 pages of testimony and multiple exhibits regarding the JP incident came in full before the jury, before any clear and convincing finding was made. The jury heard not just JP, but also a retelling of JP's story by the officer investigating the JP incident, by the sexual assault nurse examiner who examined JP following her assault, by three separate BCA agents regarding the JP incident as well. So this is not just an issue that this all came in before the jury. First of all, that's problematic because it was so voluminous, but second of all, the court could have heard all of this outside of the presence of the jury, made a ruling as to, first of all, whether the evidence was clear and convincing to begin with, and second of all, how much of this voluminous evidence should come in before the jury.
What does the record tell us about an objection to the district court deciding the Spriegel issue without having made good on what you've described as the court's promise to have a hearing?
If you're asking if counsel objected to the procedure, the answer is counsel did not. The attorneys, however, were entitled to believe that the district court would proceed in the way that it indicated in an order that it would proceed.
So I guess I want to be clear on the objection. You're not really objecting to the procedure. You're not asking us to find plain error in the district court's failure to have a proceeding. You're still only ultimately challenging the district court's determination on the Spriegel issue. Am I correct about that, or have I misunderstood your argument?
I would like you to find both.
Well, have you argued both in your brief? I guess is what.
Yes. Yes, I did. I did argue both in my brief. The first section of my argument in, as to Spriegel is regarding this procedural error and how that caused prejudice on its own before reaching the issues with the NUS factors.
But I don't know that you fully analyzed the plain error analysis of the procedural claim. And I may have misunderstood. Maybe I missed something in your briefing.
I believe I addressed prejudice in a separate section in the brief, so it is a little bit maybe unconventional in its format, and that I don't address, you know, issue error. I addressed all of the Spriegel concerns in one chunk, and then addressed the procedure or the prejudice and the error after that in a separate section. I can point you to that.
No, don't.
Like. Okay.
Don't waste your time. Okay. We have your briefing, and you've explained how you organized it. Thank you.
Thank you. So part of the concern further without having this hearing is that the court had ordered a couple different things. First, the hearing was supposed to have testimony contingent or consistent with the police report and testimony consistent with counsel's argument at the Spriegel hearing. Counsel's argument at the Spriegel hearing stated that that JP would identify her assailant. The counsel's argument at the Spriegel hearing expressly denied a need for DNA evidence and indicated that they would suffice to have that identification based on JP's testimony specifically. But as we approach the date of the trial, we know that this wouldn't happen. If there had been a hearing before the evidence came in at trial as like a mid-trial hearing, or if you know, it came in the way that it did.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I still can't follow your argument that a hearing is required, because I read the record and I understand your argument. You're saying the judge did not meet all of the NAS factors as far as determining that prejudice outweighed any probative value. But you keep coming back to this having a hearing. If the judge went ahead and considered the evidence in whatever fashion and made that determination, why does the fact you didn't have a hearing prejudice your client? I don't understand what greater leg up that would have given you.
I'm happy to reach that. So part of the issue with not having this hearing is that if they had, they would have known that JP would not identify Mr. McClendon. So the clear and convincing finding was contingent upon JP testifying contingent or consistent with the police report and testifying consistent with counsel's argument at the Spriegel hearing, which was that
if
she would identify
him. If did not identify McClendon, doesn't that work in your favor? I mean, that to me, if I was on the jury, I'd say, well, gee, he's not identified. And that would be part of what you're hearing in terms of the Spriegel testimony. How does that hurt your client?
To pivot to the clear and convincing evidence requirement, the state bears the burden of showing that Mr. McClendon, by clear and convincing evidence, completed this assault against JP in order to introduce it. Without that identification.
Didn't they have DNA evidence to identify him as the person who deposited bodily fluids on this woman?
Not at the time of the Spriegel hearing, that the prosecutor expressly stated he did not need the DNA evidence at that time. And there is no DNA evidence prior to the introduction of any of JP's Spriegel testimony that's in the record.
But they obviously had it, and it goes to whether or not there's clear and convincing evidence and whether or not he's guilty. How can there be a problem with this?
To the extent that they have evidence, we don't know what it is, and this court is unable to review it. We have hints that it was a mixture. We don't have any information specifically about what that report stated. We just don't know. And that's a problem for this court's review.
Well, the jury wasn't provided evidence that his DNA was found on her?
The clear and convincing finding was made regardless of what the jury, or should have been made prior to the jury hearing that evidence.
But they did hear that evidence, and that's what the evidence was. Isn't that true?
The question is not for the jury, it's for the judge. The clear and convincing finding should be made prior to the introduction of the evidence.
Right, Ms. Rankin, I know I'm just beating this horse. It's dead, I understand that. But in your brief, you actually used the word astronomical prejudice to your client because of the Spriegel evidence. And I understand that's a balancing thing a court has to do. But I keep hearing the astronomical prejudice to your client as being the fact that there wasn't a hearing. As Judge Kirk has asked, as Judge Kirk has stated, there's plenty of evidence against your client despite that. So how was the balancing factors of Ness not met by this court? What was the astronomical impact that you've alluded to in your brief?
So the prejudice isn't simply the failure to have a hearing. The prejudice is the voluminous evidence that came in at trial with this terrible, horrid sexual assault against JP with no definite connection to Mr. McClendon, no clear and convincing connection. The district court's order as to the probative and prejudicial balancing was fairly minimal. The court didn't conduct an in-depth balancing. They simply asserted without reasoning that this issue of consent is relevant to the defense and is therefore both probative and outweighing the unfair prejudice. The court didn't analyze the weight of the state's evidence. The court didn't analyze any risk of prejudice. It simply cursorily went through this and kind of rubber stamped, in a certain effect, this factor. On appeal here, the state argues that the case against Mr. McClendon regarding TW was strong. If that's the case, it's unclear why they would have needed this over 100 pages worth of quite condemning evidence of violent sexual assault that we don't have certain clear and convincing proof that Mr. McClendon did in fact commit. This isn't a case where we're looking at a guy who commits an offense and denies it, commits another offense of the same type and denies it, and then says, you know what, actually, I did do one of those. And then they use that one to come in to show some sort of MO of committing an offense and denying it in the past and then changing his mind. We don't have a conviction at this stage. We don't have an identification. We don't have evidence to prove by clear and convincing evidence and to support the state's burden that this should have come in as Spriegel. So the prejudice prong simply isn't analyzed by the court. It's simply admitting an alleged but unproven violent sexual assault
counsel,
and inviting propensity inference.
Counsel, are you familiar with this court's non-precedential or at the time unpublished opinion in State versus Welton III?
Please refamiliarize me.
Okay, it's a case that's almost identical to this case where a defendant in a very similar fashion sexually assaulted two different women in basically the same area, fairly close in time, separated by months, in a similar fashion. He claimed in both cases that it was consensual sex where he was going to be paying for it and he didn't pay for it. And that's what caused the problems. Sounds a whole lot like this case. And in that case, the Court of Appeals found that the Spriegel evidence was properly admitted. And wouldn't you agree that a prior opinion of this court is given some persuasion?
Certainly this court's holdings of prior cases are persuasive. Without knowing the facts of that case, I can't comfortably distinguish it for this court.
Well, counsel, just to give you a little heads up, two of the people on this panel were on that mm-hmm. panel, and the person that wrote that opinion was me. And trust me, it's on all fours with your case. So we'd have to go back and say, we're not persuaded by what we thought in 2014.
Do you have a citation for that case, please?
I do. It's 2014, Westlaw 621543.
Thank you. I will look that up as best I can during respondent's argument and try to address on rebuttal. But I would note that this case is very, very fact-rich. There are a lot of facts here. There are a lot of facts in a lot of cases, certainly, especially criminal sexual conduct cases. But ultimately, this has to be a case-by-case analysis. And unless there was a similar process issue where all of this evidence came in without any Spriegel consideration or with rubber stamping and doing the state's job for them in the Spriegel order by the district court, then I think this case would be distinguishable. Without having read it further, I can't be more specific than that, but I would imagine that the procedural process or posture is quite distinct.
Would you also agree, counsel, and I'm sure you didn't want to argue about it, so maybe you do, that the use of the two-way video here would not be error in light of the Motlin case that came out on Monday?
I don't believe that this case falls on all fours with a case that has come out recently. As far as I can tell, the fact that the two-way video is behind the judge and we've got a lack of analysis of Waller factors, not only in a direct way, but also no analysis in an implied way, I think that this case is distinct from the cases that this court has issued on that issue.
Isn't it stronger because there was a two-way video here and only a one-way video in Motlin, and that was found to be fine?
It is probably stronger, but I do believe that this case without the proper analysis has an error. I have 3 seconds left. I would just ask this court to please grant Mr. McClendon a new and fair trial free from the propensity argument. Thank you.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. Unless this court has questions on the courtroom closure claim, today I intend to just address the Spriegel and prosecutorial misconduct claims.
Well, let me then take you right off course, just on your courtroom closure argument. You begin, at least the maybe not on the merits, but on the procedural issue, you argue that the appellant forfeited this argument by failing to brief plain error. But it seems to me that the appellant expressly briefed structural error as the standard. And it seems that courtroom closure would be a de novo structural error analysis. Help me to understand why that's not so.
Well, the Motlin decision that came out on Monday actually addresses that and says it doesn't need to reach the issue, but points out that there's sort of conflicting case law on that. Structural error really just means you don't do a prejudice analysis. There isn't any case law that I've ever seen that says it means even if you don't object, you don't have to meet the plain error test. Now, structural error will often meet the plain error test because it's an error that's previously been identified as structural error. But I'm not aware of any case law that says you can make new law, create a new category of structural error if you never gave a judge a chance to fix it in the first place. The whole point of the plain error doctrine is you should give the judge a chance to avoid the error, and that didn't happen here.
Right, but if we found as a matter of law that the courtroom was unconstitutionally closed, there's really nothing left of a plain error. I mean, what are the elements of a plain error analysis that could possibly overcome the structural error disposition?
Well, plain error isn't just error. It's error that's clear and obvious. It's error that violates existing precedent. You can't make new categories of structural error or any kind of error under the plain error doctrine. It has to be something that was already there. It was so obvious that the judge really messed up by not sua sponte acting. And that's my argument here. And the Motlin decision, in any event, finds there's no error. And as already noted, the Motlin decision is actually under our facts here are better than in Motlin. I've pointed out a couple unpublished decisions where this court reached the same result. So for now, the law is that two-way video or even one-way video is not improper courtroom closure. And it sounds like that case that may already be before the Supreme Court in a first-degree murder case. But this court follows its own precedent under Chauvin and under Motlin, appellant clearly loses.
Sure, I didn't want to, I've taken you now several minutes off train, so I'll let you get back.
That's an interesting topic, Your Honor, but I will focus on the other two today, and I guess I'll focus mainly on Spriegel, since that's most of what we talked about. That argument's been thoroughly briefed, so I'll focus mostly on what was talked about today and what's in the reply brief. I submitted a supplemental authority letter, and that letter makes clear with the case it cites that the issue here is whether the judge improperly admitted the evidence, not did she make a mistake in the way she analyzed the evidence. The end result is what matters here. And what really matters here is, even if she made a mistake in the procedure, was there prejudice? And there wasn't any prejudice here because there is DNA evidence. And even though JP didn't identify appellant in the courtroom, she described someone that meets his description. The DNA evidence ties him to this case. And that's ultimately why he admitted that he had sex with JP, but just said it was consensual. So the only possible prejudice here is, well, if there had been this hearing, the evidence wouldn't have come in. I don't know what other prejudice there could be, but the evidence was clearly admissible. There is clear and convincing evidence here. Appellant has mentioned a couple of times the voluminous Spriegel evidence, but this, if there had been a Spriegel hearing, it wouldn't have been with every single Spriegel witness. It would have just been with the victim. And so that wouldn't have done anything regarding this allegedly voluminous evidence. And importantly, appellant never objected at trial and said, hey, even if the Spriegel's coming in, this is too voluminous. You should cut witnesses 3, 4, and 5 and only allow witnesses 1 and 2 or limit the testimony from some of these other witnesses. Appellant never, ever raised that below and gave the judge a chance to address it. And there clearly isn't any plain error here. There isn't even any plain error argument. Appellant only addresses plain error in the prejudice setting, but plain error is much more than just prejudice. Plain error is, can you cite precedent that shows this is such an obvious error that the judge had a duty to sua sponte act, even though the defense didn't do anything?
Can you address where you believe the issue of the district court's procedural decision fits into the Spriegel analysis?
Well, there's two problems here with the procedural argument. One is that appellant never objected at trial and said, hey, judge, you promised me a hearing. Why haven't we had our hearing? And there was a bench conference right before this evidence came in, but it wasn't recorded. And so for all we know, at that bench conference, defense counsel said, you know, Your Honor, the prosecutor said that the Spriegel victim will testify consistent with what she's already said. She's right here. Let's just get on with it. For all we know, that's what defense counsel said. There's no record here. Yeah, I'm speculating, but it's appellant's burden here. And appellant could have created a record on this through post-conviction if appellant thought the record was inadequate. So we have a bench conference. After the bench conference, the Spriegel evidence comes in. No one ever says, hey, judge, what about our hearing? So we've got a forfeiture. Maybe we've got an express waiver. We just don't know. We certainly don't have any prejudice because even if there had been a hearing, there was certainly plenty of evidence to admit this here. There's the DNA evidence. And let's talk about that for a second. In the Spriegel order, the judge says that she has received the DNA results. So clearly the judge knew those DNA results before trial, and the DNA results were discussed at trial. It's a bit insulting to describe the judge's order as a rubber stamp. I mean, this is a detailed 9-page order, and she excluded one of the two other rapes. If she was rubber stamping, she would have let both of the state's Spriegel cases in, but she didn't. She was careful about this. Judge Starr did not abuse her discretion because there was clearly clear and convincing evidence, given the DNA evidence, given the description of appellant. And again, that's why appellant ultimately admitted that he did this. He just claimed consent. And ultimately, as we know, he pled guilty to this later. So there's no interest of justice in remanding this under the fourth prong of the plain error test, if nothing else. The Spriegel evidence really isn't a close issue. I mean, there are 8 similarities here that I've described in my brief. There isn't any case I've found or the defense has ever cited that where a court found an abuse of discretion in admitting Spriegel evidence like this. And the jurors were properly instructed, and this court has to presume the jurors followed those instructions about the limited use of the Spriegel evidence. And I believe both attorneys reminded the jury in closing about the limited use of the Spriegel evidence. So given all the evidence here, given the proper jury instructions, appellant can't meet his burden of showing either an abuse of discretion or prejudice. And unless there are other questions on the Spriegel issue, I'll move on to the prosecutorial misconduct claim and what's said about that in the reply brief.
Counsel, just a quick question, and I'm not sure it merits it, but I'm going to ask a question, I guess. this case, to me, for the state, seemed very strong, even with the consent argument, given the nature of her testimony that he punched her and then the corroboration of the injuries she suffered and the like. And, you know, we used to always kind of wait till the state was done with their case and determine if they had a weak case before we even considered Spriegel. Can you tell me why the state's case was weak? I mean, that goes to the relevancy and importance of Spriegel.
Your Honor, I may be wrong here, but I thought the Supreme Court had repudiated the weak case requirement. But I mean, I get what you're saying. It still goes.
They changed it from a requirement to a consideration, right. But it's still a consideration. And so I guess I'm addressing it from that standpoint.
Right. I understand that. And ultimately, this is, in some senses, a he said, she said case, because he claimed consent. And if there was consent here, it would explain the DNA evidence. And he had an explanation for her injuries, implausible as that explanation may be. So this was not a slam dunk. We didn't have what happened here on video. We didn't have a confession. The victim was a homeless woman. And, you know, there's no predicting how a jury is going to react to a testimony from a victim or from someone in that situation. And certainly there was very aggressive cross-examination here. So really, what you'd have to find is the judge abused her discretion by finding that the probative value was not outweighed by the danger of prejudice. And a key fact here is that the jurors were properly instructed repeatedly on how to use the Spriegel evidence, and that eliminates the danger of unfair prejudice. This court has said it must presume the jurors followed those instructions, and the instructions told the jurors they couldn't convict based on the Spriegel evidence. That the Spriegel evidence just went to whether the state proved its case involving TW. They couldn't convict based on JP. And again, JP didn't identify appellant in the courtroom, so arguably that undercut her testimony somewhat. So this is not a case where there's a clear abuse of discretion here, and certainly not one where there was prejudice in that, but for the Spriegel evidence, the jurors most likely would have believed appellant's changing implausible story and not believed TW despite her injuries and despite her consistent explanation of what happened and her reaction at the time where she was on video trying to flag down cars to get someone to call 911 for her. That maybe was a longer answer than you were looking for here, but unless there are additional questions on the Spriegel, I would like to just quickly get to the prosecutorial misconduct issue in case this court has questions on it, and to address what appellant says in his reply brief, because the problem here is that the defense attorney did not object to the prosecutor's closing argument. So clearly we're in plain error land where you have to identify on point case law that says you can't do this sort of thing. What the prosecutor did here was use the modus operandi evidence to argue modus operandi. Appellant admitted that he preys on homeless women. He solicits them for sex because he thinks they probably need the money, but sometimes he doesn't pay them after he's done. So he preys on homeless women. He admitted that. That's what the prosecutor argued in closing. This isn't a case like some of the ones cited by appellant where there was no Spriegel modus operandi evidence. This was a focused argument. There was no objection to it. It's not plain error. And even if the prosecutor did make any misstatements, the jurors were properly instructed. The evidence was strong. There's no reasonable possibility that but for what the prosecutor said, the jurors would have acquitted. And in terms of the argument about the prosecutor's cross-examination, defense never asked to have anything struck from the record here. The prosecutor didn't introduce any evidence improperly or make suggestions to evidence that had been excluded or that wasn't admissible. This was just a hard-fought, aggressive case.
But the prosecutor did make a number of editorial comments, so to speak, at the end of answers by the defendant. And the court even sustained a couple of objections to that and admonished the prosecutor to just ask questions. But for whatever reason, the editorial comments seem to have continued.
That's true, Your Honor. And I'm sure the prosecutor would do differently if he had to do it over again. I mean, this was a hard-fought, emotional case. But the prosecutor's editorial comments weren't introducing evidence that wouldn't have come in. this is really just an aggressive cross-examination where the prosecutor is saying, oh, okay, so now that's what you're telling us. Oh, your memory's gotten better over time. These are appropriate topics for cross-examination. And again, defense counsel never asked to have anything struck here. And defense counsel was very aggressive in his own way with this and violated some rules. And that is certainly relevant to any sort of prejudice analysis.
And just so I'm clear on your prosecutorial misconduct and your overarching argument, when it comes to Spriegel, the evidence was not especially strong. When it comes to prejudice regarding prosecutorial misconduct, the evidence was particularly strong.
Well, I think in what I'm saying on the Spriegel is going into this, the prosecutor had no reason to think, oh, this is a slam dunk, I'm definitely going to win. Now, at the end of the day, given what appellant admitted in his testimony, at the end of the day, the evidence was strong. So any Spriegel error was harmless, just like any prosecutorial error argument was harmless. But this wasn't one of those cases coming in where we've got it on video. We've got a confession. We've got seven eyewitnesses who are all upstanding members of the community. This wasn't a slam dunk. That's why the state wanted the Spriegel evidence, and that's why Judge Starr didn't abuse her discretion in admitting it. And with 5 seconds left, unless this court has additional questions, I'll simply ask that you affirm Judge Starr and the jury's verdict. Thank you.
Thank you. And it doesn't appear as if either of the other two panel members have any further questions, and I do not. So thank you. Counsel for appellant, rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to start with Welton. I had a brief moment to review that. I did note in Welton, the Court of Appeals indicated the record does not include overwhelming non-Spriegel evidence on the issue of consent for the charged case. That is a major distinguishing factor here. We had TW's consistent and repeated statements of non-consensuality. We had recitations of those statements by medical personnel, by officers. So that's a major distinguishing factor here that definitely goes towards the weight of the evidence of the state's case. And a way to distinguish this case from Welton. I would just, like to briefly touch on the predator-prey closing argument here. Even if this court doesn't find that the Spriegel on its own is a reversible issue or that the predator-prey theme on its own is a reversible issue, which they both are, as indicated in appellant's brief, together they make a cumulative error that deprived Mr. McClendon of a fair trial. The issue or the point of Spriegel is to paint a new picture or to paint the same picture, to complete the picture of the defendant, not to paint a new one. Here in closing argument, the prosecutor inescapably evoked the emotional reaction of the jury, which they are not supposed to do per Janky, by painting a picture of Mr. McClendon as a man who seeks out vulnerable women, takes advantage of their vulnerability to assault them, and then uses that vulnerability to get away with the assault. The closing paints a picture of silent victims, of victims who no one believes, but the evidence doesn't bear that out. Here, the victims neither were silent, neither were not believed. Both were believed and so thoroughly believed that we have multiple individuals coming in to testify with the same story every time. So this is simply not a case where we're looking at a silent victim who's unable to testify. Who's unable to be believed. This picture that's being painted here is problematic, prejudicial, and should not be allowed because it certainly inflamed the passions of the jury, which is not permissible. The prosecutor even went so far as to say the quiet part out loud in closing. He said, Mr. McClendon, quote, knew he had done this before and gotten away with it, or so he thought. This is nothing but a propensity argument. This is asking the jury plainly to make that propensity inference. He did it before. He must have done it this time. That is unacceptable closing argument. This propensity argument in closing shows the danger of the overwhelming Spriegel.
That may be true, Ms. Rankin, but we also have to keep in mind that your client did testify and indicated he'd done this before. And I'm not talking about a criminal act, but he's acknowledged that he's done this before.
There's a very big distinction between engaging in consensual, albeit illegal, business transactions for sex and engaging in non-consensual criminal assault. He had not done this before. He had patronized women for sex acts, which this court likely frowns upon as the law does, but ultimately is a very different act than a non-consensual assault. He had not done this before. I see I have approximately a minute and a half left. I would also just like to briefly note here, is there a question, Judge Ross? Sorry, I saw you on mute and heard you on mute. I would like to note here as well, counsel is speculating about what the Spriegel hearing would have had. Given that the JP was unable to identify Mr. McClendon, a Spriegel hearing would have had to have more evidence than just her testimony. In order for the state to meet its burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. McClendon had committed this previous offense against JP, the state would have had to tie him to that offense. JP would not have been able to do that. In fact, she identified someone else with 80% certainty. So her testimony at a hearing outside of the presence of the jury, any kind of Spriegel hearing, would not have accomplished that proof, and the state would have had to bring in other evidence. We don't know what that would have been. We can make assumptions or presumptions, but we just don't have that information. We do know that it would have had to be more than just her testimony, though, because her testimony did not align with the police reports and with counsel's assertions at Spriegel, as the district court indicated would be required in order for this evidence to be admissible as clear and convincing in its order. I see I have 8 seconds left. Again, I would ask this court, for the reasons I've discussed today and for the reasons in Pellin's brief, to reverse Mr. McClendon's convictions and grant him a new and fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your briefing and your argument in this matter. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. We've taken the matter under advisement. Thank you for your argument and have a great day.
Have a great day. Take care, all.